This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Today, my guest is Jessica Coslow, owner of Squirrel in LA. Jessica started her professional career baking in Atlanta, Georgia. She's also worked in TV production in LA and New York City. She has been named LA's Chef of the Year by Eater, and she recently published a cookbook, Everything I Want to Eat, which was nominated for a James Beard Award. Alice Waters has said about her, "Jessica's cooking is always in tune with the seasons, and I admire her approach to food that is pure and beautiful." She has a new restaurant that she is working on right now in Los Angeles, and she's here in New York cooking at the South Seaport. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. What's up?
So you're from Long Beach. You are true. A California girl born and raised. I want to hear what it is like growing up in Long Beach in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s.
Whoa.
What's life like on the shore over there?
I always say that people think that it's... I think my existence is very different than what you maybe have seen on TV. Mm-hmm. I grew up figure skating, so Long Beach was a place that I rested my head. I was always usually a rink rat and at the rink. Also, humorously, my mom's a dermatologist, so I would be lathered in sunscreen most of my days. And even though our backyard is a boat dock, there was no boat in it. So growing up in Long Beach, my version of it is very different than what we all might expect. I would say the funniest thing that I can say is that I did grow... My mom is a single mother, and I'm an only child. And I had a nanny growing up, and she was Snoop Dogg's girlfriend in sixth grade and went to high school together.
So you've got that LBC connection.
Yeah, I've got connection. And actually, she bought me his first CD, Snoop's first CD. She took me to the warehouse. It was like, all right, like, don't tell your mom.
Too young to be listening to that probably.
Yeah. But we're going to get you doggy style. And I was like, this is amazing. So I felt in line, even though I was a nerdy little girl ice skating for my entire adolescence.
That's an interesting choice, because I wouldn't think that Southern California is a ice skating, you know, capital of the United States. It seems like a very difficult place to do a lot of ice skating, right? I wouldn't think there'd be like tons of rinks around.
Well, that's why the figure skaters there are so good, is because here it's considered like a pastime. Like, oh, it's so lovely, it's a pastime. But in California, it's a profession.
How serious did you get into it?
Oh, I was on the U.S. team for 4 years.
Okay, so you were...
I was trying to get it, really.
Were you like Olympics bound in that capacity?
I thought so, but I did not pass go. I competed in a sport that was removed from the Olympics in like the late 80s. And
what sport is that?
It's called school figures. I mean, I did it all, but like I was national champion in school figures. So, you know, if that was a sport that it's why Peggy Fleming won the Olympics. It's why Chris Yamaguchi was happy when it was no longer in the Olympics, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Why did you stop skating?
I mean, the sport, I competed till its very end. I competed the last competition in like 1999. And it's kind of having a resurgence right now, but that was like the last national world competition, and I won that. So you know, that's it. Now I gotta. Now I have to cook. I had to find something else
to
do.
You had to get a different job.
I had to get a different job, and that job is cooking.
This might be a reach, but I figure if you're at like, if you're at peak athletic performance, you're probably very concerned about what was going in your body, even at a very young age. Your mom sounds like she was kind of strict. I'm curious about what type of food home you had growing up.
Yeah.
What got purchased? What got eaten? Like, were you already influenced by that sort of Southern California market farm ethos or not yet?
Yeah. You know, my mom and I would go, there was a farmer's market in Long Beach outside of what was considered like a Home Depot. It's called Dooley's. And every week we would go and get sprouts from the sprouts guy. And we would make this tuna salad together. That was basically just like tuna and lemon juice and sprouts. And that was, I would say, it feels very like, the healthy, protein oriented, and also like light, market driven in its own way. And that was kind of my earliest memories with cooking with my mom was, you know, eating light, eating well. I mean, I was also a really big fan of the Coco's chicken salad. So, back then it was really food for fuel. It wasn't, food, an exploration of food. So I think once I stopped skating, that's really when I was like, oh my God, what have I missed out on for the last like 20 years of my life? So then I deep dived.
Did you go to a normal high school? Were you traveling too much in order to have kind of that normal childhood, elementary school, high school experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did go to a normal, I went to a private school basically until I graduated high school. But I skated in the morning from like 5 a.m. to 7. So I would have to get up at like 4:15 and then I would get out of school at 1. So I missed all the extracurriculars afterwards. So, you know, I did spend the majority of my, you know, all of my teens, kind of living this dual life of trying to be a normal kid and also not being a normal kid.
After you finished high school, you went to Brandeis. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you went to Georgetown. Mm-hmm. So restaurants are often loaded with people who may not have even finished high school. They are often really safe, welcoming places to people that have taken a different path in their life that haven't necessarily gone to school. You have a master's degree. I'm curious, how valuable or not has your college experience been to like transitioning to the restaurant world?
I think each person has their own path, you know, to what works for them. I'm diverging right now, but right now we're at South Street Seaport and some of the cooks that are there are somewhat interns from the Food and Finance High School here in Manhattan. And there's 60 students, I guess, a year that are in this extracurricular program of culinary work. So these kids are 16 years old, 17 years old, and they already know where they want to go to. They want to go to a college that has a hospitality program. They're in the kitchen with us, cooking, prepping, plating. They have a strong idea of who they are already. And that's really empowering. And that's their trajectory. Some of them are like, all right, well, I want to go into the military and like and cook. And for me, it was a different path to get to where I am now. Like I learned a lot going to college, doing economics, thinking about finance and business. And in graduate school, it was a larger layer of more like working in the digital world. So it made me very aware of not only maybe how to run a business, but also how to have a voice that felt consistent and thoughtful in the digital space. And then I started cooking, and that helped me understand key points in the kitchen and what it meant to be a part of a team building dishes that would eventually make their way to a table. So that's my experience, and it really helped to give a greater understanding of what I needed to actually build maybe a restaurant or a couple that could have their own strong sense of voice and sense of place. And yeah.
Before you did jump into cooking full time, though, you got your master's in media theory, mm-hmm. and then you ended up working at Fox, and you were working in TV production, correct?
Yeah.
I want to know what's media theory, and also what was it like working in the TV world? You know, when you were doing production and you were sort of involved in Hollywood, but you were also you were living in New York, right? Before mm-hmm. you jump back to LA. So yeah. can you just kind of take us through like grad school through your time yeah. in New York and kind of what that was like a little bit?
Yeah. Grad school was great. I felt like that was my college experience where it was at Georgetown. And the media theory program, a lot of the people who are that were in my class, they either get their PhD and become they become teachers at universities about media and what's happening in digital and not digital space. A lot of them work at Yahoo. That's probably not true. They probably work at Google, you know, or Facebook. Yahoo, I don't know. They used to work at Yahoo, but they're probably not there. They're probably at Google. And then some of them are like producers and developers of content. And that's really what I was doing. I went and I first moved to Atlanta after college and was cooking. And then I moved here and to New York and got a job at Fox, where I was working with a number of different television shows and producing all of their digital content.
Was there a specific moment when you were in New York and you thought back to Atlanta and you thought, maybe have I made the wrong decision? Do I want to be in food? Or was there a duration of like fulfillment and satisfaction in New York when you were working in TV?
Yeah, I think there's both. I think, when you jump into the food world, you wonder how you're going to make it work financially for you. It's all about the work you put in and you're climbing. And I got really nervous about how to make it work financially for me. And so I moved to New York and took the job at Fox, where I was making a lot of money, but I also was emotionally unsatisfied. And the thing about the job, though, was that it taught me, as a producer, it taught me how many different people are important to making something work. So in the kitchen, it's not just about, or in a restaurant, it's not just about the cooks. Like it's about it's about service, and it's about the plates and the customer experience and the holistic space. And a lot of times people don't think about that. You know, each role might find their role to be the only role, but it's everyone working in tandem. It's a band. It's the drummer. It's the guitar player. It's the singer. It's everyone together. So that's what working at Fox kind of taught me, you know?
So I want to hear about this overnight baking gig that you had little while. So your job takes you back to LA, right?
Yeah.
So you're still working in TV, mm-hmm. and then you think for some crazy reason that it's a smart idea to bake overnight while still maintaining your day job.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, it was
tell us about how that went down. Where were you baking? Like how did that come to be?
It was not a cool look. I mean, I had moved to LA and my ex is a winemaker in Napa now, and we had moved from New York to LA because we were together going to move up to Napa, and hopefully I was going to start something up there, and he was going to get into wine up there or work further in wine up there. And so I started this transition period where I was the overnight baker, and I was the only one. So I was doing like wholesale bread, like huge 50, 60, 80 pound batches of dough, overnight from midnight to 8 a.m. And it was at the Village Bakery. It was really the only place doing like decent bread at the time. And then I would come home, I would sleep for 2 hours and I would go to Fox and I would literally like sleep at my desk. It was a very bad look on me particularly.
How long did you do that for? Was it like a couple of weeks?
No, I did it for like 6 months. And then I ended up leaving and going back to Atlanta to help Ann Quattrano, my mentor, open her or be, I was there for the fall Christmas time for Abattoir, which is a restaurant she had with a chef out there.
In Atlanta?
Yeah.
Cool. So can you tell us a little bit about her, the project in Atlanta that she was opening, but also is it Bacchanalia that you...
Bacchanalia
that you started at?
I mean, I feel like Ann Quattrano is like this magical woman that in the food industry people know and love, but she doesn't have as much... like people know who Alice Waters is. Mm-hmm. And I feel as if people know who Alice Waters is, they should absolutely know who Ann Quattrano is because, she has a huge farm where a lot of her products come out of in Georgia. She has a restaurant called Star Provisions. She had Quiñones and Abattoir, and Bacchanalia is still around and Star Provisions and Bacchanalia just opened in its new iteration in a new space. And so, you know, she's someone who doesn't rest on her laurels. She had this space for probably 20 years that Star Provisions and Bacchanalia lived in. And she realized it was time to move it. And so she moved it. And I think there's something really powerful in being like, look, this is my livelihood, my business, and times change and I need to change with them. Her food has always been 100% Southern, and she's connected to her team, her people. She's really someone who I respect in how she runs her restaurants.
You say that she's someone that you look up to. She's a mm-hmm. mentor. How much contact are you in with her these days since you're embarking on a new project and you open up a restaurant? Like, do you lean on her for stuff?
I do. I see her a couple times a year, actually. And I always have reached out to her to say, you know, this is new territory. Like I worked in fine dining at her restaurants and now I'm going back into dinner service and I have questions and she has answers, but she never tells me that her answers are the right answers. She just says, look, this is my experience from like 30 years in business. Take what you will.
Is there anyone else in LA that you consider a mentor that you lean on, that you speak to often to ask these questions to as you move from a wildly popular spot that's sort of front loaded in the day to your next project, which is going to be a nighttime spot?
You know, Ori, who has Bestia, mm-hmm. I actually talk to him quite a lot because he is a beast in the kitchen. He's just a beast. And I say that in a positive way because that restaurant is packed every single night. They do thousands of covers probably a night. And the consistency of the food at the number of people that they're serving is so high. And that is rare. It is rare to go to a restaurant that is serving an exponentially huge number of people a night and have it be delicious. And there's something to be said for the kind of team that he's built, that he continues to build, the food that he's figured out and how he layers it. And so I talk to him. I see like, and he's just, you know, if he doesn't like it, it's over. Like he's ready to move on. He's not afraid to say, you know what, that's not working. He doesn't like, you know, pick at it. And he's been really helpful in kind of formulating dinner for me.
Let's jump back to breakfast though. How did Squirrel come to be? How did the idea for maybe jam, if that's how it started in mm-hmm. your head, become what Squirrel is currently today?
Yeah. I mean, when you think of jam, I think you think of breakfast. You know, you think of toast, you might think of a porridge or oatmeal with a little jam. So it needed to feel honest in that regard. And I couldn't imagine going from a jam company to dinner. It didn't make sense. So going to to breakfast and lunch made sense. And that's why it is. I mean, I just came from a little breakfast or a bakery here in Bushwick, and he started by making breads. And so, of course, there's toast and lots of different options on that. So that's where you feel it's natural. It's a natural fit.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about Squirrel and, of course, the new project opening in Los Angeles. Stick with us here on Heritage Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm here with Jessica Coslow from Los Angeles, the chef and owner of Squirrel. She's going to be opening up a new project very soon called Tell. Before we get to that, I do want to continue talking about Squirrel. I want to know why that neighborhood and why that spot. Did you look at lots of different spaces? Was it one of the first ones you saw? Like, how did you end up you ended up?
How the hell did I get there?
For listeners that have never been to LA or have never been to the restaurant, can you give us a little geography lesson? Like, where is it in reference to something they may have heard of?
It's in East Hollywood. It's on the corner of Virgil and Marathon. And it's basically the backside of Silver Lake. So one block parallel east is actually Silver Lake, but it is essentially East Hollywood. And when I moved there in 2011, that location, that street itself had nothing. It was basically a street that people drove down and didn't walk down and didn't really know it existed. And now it's becoming a thing. I found it on Craigslist. I found it. It was Gus's lunchbox before, and he was selling his lease for $10,000. And so that's why I moved there, because it was 5 minutes from my house. And I was just at the time making jam and having jam classes. And I didn't think that I needed people to go there. I just wanted a place that was near my home and easy to get to. And so that's why I did it.
How did you transition into doing a build out and actually creating a space where people could come in, order at a counter, and have some seating? Like, was that your idea? Did it click in? Was there a partner involved that sort of swayed you in that direction?
No, I don't have a partner with Squirrel. It's like, it's been really, it's all formed by itself. So that was an easy transition, because it was once a cafe. It was a taco spot, and just kind of making it again a place that people can go and get a bite at was, we already had the health permit. It was just a real quick close and reopen kind of situation.
So how long were you open as a jam factory / classroom before you opened as Squirrel?
A year and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we opened Squirrel in October of 2012, the cafe. And then we, Squirrel started in March of 2011.
What's the name in reference to?
Squirreling things away, which is, an old time preserving term. And it's a girl who squirrels, and that's the name. Yeah.
How immediate was the neighborhood response to Squirrel once you open as a place where people could sit down and eat?
What's so
you know, coming from New York and coming from, like, I had moved back to LA in 2008 from New York, and I lived in Greenpoint in 2008. And the thing that I missed most were these places where I could go and feel like I was a part of a community and I could have a coffee and maybe a little bite to eat and feel really neighborly. There was nothing like that in Silver Lake. And a lot of people compare Williamsburg and Silver Lake. And I too think, okay, well, I dug a hole from New York and I popped up in my home. But the only thing that was around was Intelligentsia, which is a coffee shop. And it's pretty, it's still there, still really large. And that was like the meeting ground. There was no small, like humble place where it really felt like people knew your name, like the daytime cheers. And so that's why I wanted to have a place like Squirrel. Was it immediate that people started to flock there? No, it was a slow build. I mean, by 2013, like May of 2013, I think that was when a piece came out in Bon Appetit, and that was really when we blew up. You know, Jonathan Gold wrote his review; it was really positive, and then Bon Appetit, and that was the kicker of like, oh my gosh, this is actually working. Until then, it was a lot of playing, figuring out what worked and what didn't.
How does that feel when you wake up and you're doing something that you started? You see that there's a great line, the demand is there. You see that you're selling lots of wonderful things that you're making, and that there's rave reviews, there's critical acclaim. Does that to you feel like reinforcement? Does it scare you? Does it make you happy? How does it make you feel?
How's it make you feel? I mean, I think that's a great question to ask everyone. I mean, I think there's always this little bit of fear of like, okay, that's going to end tomorrow, which is also a good thing because it keeps me pushing. I think the most rewarding thing is that it's helped to build a team of people beyond me that are also really passionate about what they do, and they're bringing new ideas and new creative spirit and ingenuity into the restaurant. And so that's what I'm most excited about, is like this continual brain exploration that happens at Squirrel because there's excitement around what we're doing.
I want to talk about your cookbook.
Yeah.
Not only because of the content, but specifically the cover. I think... you've done a lot of interesting things with the cookbook that deviate from the norm. So chefs agonize over the cover of their cookbooks. And for those that are listening right now, I suggest that you maybe Google the cover of the cookbook so you can kind of follow along with us as Jessica describes it. But, there were some design wars that you had over this cookbook cover, right?
Yeah, did you see that piece?
I did. Yeah. I saw this great piece online, which was exciting to read because when I saw your cookbook, I was struck immediately by it, by how different it was from the traditional cookbook. So for those that are driving or can't really Google it right now, can you just briefly describe the finished cover and what it looks like?
Mm-hmm. There's a jacket, which automatically is different from the norm because I think a lot of books now don't have a jacket. There's a photo on the hard cover. The jacket is white, which is also a challenge for a lot of publishers to get behind because they can get dirty easily. I would say there's a border around that white, and the photo is the rest of the front cover. And that photo is a hand that's coming into basically a table scene. The copy on the front cover, on the jacket, does not go into the photo, which I think is kind of like a Bon Appetit thing where the copy is on the photo. But I think we tried to give a lot of space for the copy and the font to live separately from the image. And then underneath the jacket is is the actual other cover, which a lot of people also remove the jacket and just keep on their book. They keep the book on the coffee table. It seems a little bit more coffee table-like. Just one font, all the same size, and it's a really beautiful, beautiful cover.
Yeah, the thing that really jumps out at you is that it's not apparent immediately that it's a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Because the photo is, it's so, it's bright, but it's not glossy. And while the food is very apparent, it almost looks like it's just an artist photograph of a table setting, and the arm kind of coming in is disorienting a little bit. So I'm curious, like, so I know that Scott Berry was involved in this process as well. Can you just talk a little bit about like some of the iterations and how your publisher and you, like, how did you make it to this point? I think a lot of chefs and people listening to this show that own a lot of cookbooks, they always wonder, like, how do you get from point A to point B once you come up with the idea for the cookbook and you say, all right, we're putting the these 80 recipes in it. Like, how do you get from that, the copy, to that finished product, you know?
Well, I guess I want to say one thing, which is, I don't know if you read the Eater piece that came out recently, but it also discussed two cookbooks that one recently came out and one's coming out this fall that now basically have the covers that the Squirrel Cookbook has.
I didn't see that, no. So you're like, you've set a new path.
Yeah, so now we've set a new precedent for what a cookbook cover can be, because what has been selling a lot of times is what cookbook publishers really want is basically a photo of a round bowl on the cover of the book. And that was something that, if you look at the Squirrel Cookbook in relation to all the other cookbooks that had come out last fall, it was like this strange book that stood out between every other book that had like a round looking bowl on the cover. So we went back and forth with the publisher, because we didn't really want a photo on the cover. We wanted a jacket, and we wanted that jacket to be able to come off to kind of showcase a different cover, underneath. But it was, we went through everything under the sun, from big font, small font, no font, all photo. And we settled on the cookbook. I think the other thing is that Scott Berry, is a part of Squirrel. Like I said, I don't have any partners. I don't have any financial partners, but I do think of Scott as my partner. He is a creative director of Squirrel. He does all the design elements, from the jar to any sort of posters, any sort of new furniture that's at the restaurant, the signs that are outside, to our website and to the book. And so what that meant was that the book, we created that and handed it over to the publisher, done. We didn't actually let the publisher touch it. They didn't form it. They formatted it, they cleaned it up, but they didn't design any pages, the cover. And that's a rare thing. So that's something that Squirrel does that maybe other restaurants don't do, is basically have a creative agency inside of the restaurant doing all this interesting design work.
Let's continue talking about creativity and photography and visuals and how you present the restaurant. Squirrel has a lot of Instagram followers. People tend to be very into Instagramming their food these days. I'm curious about what your thoughts are. Is it, you know, it's a lot of people consider it like a necessary evil. Are you on board? Are you against it? Like, what do you feel about social media and how it's impacted Squirrel?
I think I'm on board, because I think it can inspire it. We use Instagram as a place to catalog the inspirational things that we do. So if we're inspired at the restaurant, we post whatever dish that is, because it's interesting. It pushed our buttons, it pushed our boundaries, and hopefully it can push yours. And I think it's great for people to take photos of the food, because it can inspire them. Or it's like, all right, I checked it off the list. I was there, you know, like I ate here. there's also this guy called Toothpicks out of LA. And I don't know if you know who that guy is, but his Instagram videos are hilarious. He likes to be like the Instagram Yelp. So what he does is he makes these like 15-second videos of a restaurant that like basically define it. And the one for Squirrel was that these guys went to Squirrel. They ordered, they sat down, they were delivered their food, took a bunch of photos, and then the server came back, said, "Are you done?" And they're like, "Yeah." And they took it away. So they never actually ate the food. They just Instagrammed it. So yeah, I mean, that's the future, and I'm on board. Hopefully you eat it while it's still hot though.
I want to know about the new restaurant. I want to know where it is and what you're going to be doing there, but also, can you talk about this farm in Malibu that was once a cactus mm-hmm. farm, and it is a drought tolerant farm. Is
yeah.
that correct?
Yeah.
Please tell the listeners
where do I
about
start?
That.
Okay. Can I start with the farm?
Start with the farm and okay. then tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing at the restaurant.
Yeah. So the farm is 3 acres. It's a huge lot of land, but the plot that's the farm is 3 acres. To me, what's really important and how we're planting it out is, it is drought tolerant. It's about planting what the surroundings and nature can provide. So in this area, obviously it's Southern California, water resources are tight. There's a lot of salinity that is in the water because of its proximity to the ocean. And it's also has some boron in the soil. So we're working through all these things. It turns out coffee grinds are really good for the soil. But the point is planting things that really define what can grow in that area without using or overusing water resources. So for example, in California and around the world, we are in the US at least, we love arugula, but arugula is a really big water suck and we shouldn't be using it. So that's not something that we're planting there. We're actually planting a lot of carob. We have a lot of citrus and avocados that are just kind of like already on the property, but, passion fruit, dragon fruit, carob, those are things that, are uniquely, not tall plums also that kind of just grow, without the need for, a lot of water. And by farming in this way, we're championing certain ingredients that hopefully we can bring awareness and value to, not only for ourselves, but for other chefs in our community and farmers in the community.
And so the new restaurant, which came first, the farm or the restaurant?
I mean, it all came together. It was kind of like I do have a partner for this project. She's amazing. And this was something that she had. And I came in to say, okay, this is what we're doing. This is how we're going to define it. This is the next project.
And so you're calling it Tell.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that name mean? And what's the food going to be like?
Mm. Okay, so Tell in archaeology is a mound that is formed through the accumulated layers of civilizations living on the same site for hundreds of thousands of years. So it's made of lives, of civilizations, of creative things left behind. And I think that there's something really powerful in calling a restaurant that, especially since for me, this was a deep dive into my heritage. This was I am Jewish. I'm curious and intrigued by my own Jewish culinary history, but also the history of the people, of our people, and how they've moved and traveled throughout the world and taken certain ingredients and dishes and techniques and flavors with them, and how around the world they've developed into whatever dishes are iconic in that region. And, you know, seeing it through a California lens, it is its own perspective. I'm not trying to create an Israeli restaurant. I'm not trying to do an Ashkenazi, like a deli, you know. But I am thinking about those flavors and ingredients and dishes and making them their own thing in under an LA sunshine.
I'm curious if you can expand on this. So you said my passion is inseminating these flavors from my childhood, Middle Eastern pairings with an Ashkenazi sensibility into California cuisine, which is pretty much exactly what you were just saying. Is there a specific dish that you're working on right now or that you have in development that you feel is a really solid representation of what you're trying to put forth?
Yeah, you know, so we are at South Street Seaport this week. It ends on the 2nd. Which is Saturday. And the dishes that we're doing there are representative of some of the dishes that will be at Tell. And again, I think also the layers in this new restaurant are, some of those layers are like techniques that we've pulled from being at Squirrel. So we have a dish there that's malawach, that's a Yemenite flatbread that's like really flaky and layered. And instead of being, and it's served with like almost, it's like Bubby's like lacto fermented pickles that have been brunoised, and they're in like a labneh cream cheesy kind of thing. And like dill pickles in cream cheese already is delicious. And you might be like, oh, that's a Russ and Daughters, you know? But it's actually with malawa. It's not with a bagel. And, we're doing a sturgeon, which we think might be smoked, but instead it's cooked perfectly. It's Passmore Ranch from California. It comes with a hulba, which is this fenugreek, when it sits in water, it will ferment and turn into a foam. And it's served with smoked Santa Rosa plums that are then dried, which is very similar technique that's done in Poland. So it is really marrying these kind of like flavors and techniques from everywhere under our guise.
So you started Squirrel, you don't have any partners, and now you're moving into a bigger space. You have a partner now. I assume that with the rave reviews and critical acclaim that you've been approached by investors and people that would love to, you know, turn the Squirrel into the next blank, you know, they always say that going from one to two is the most difficult. And then I've had people on the show that say like one to two was the hardest. And then when I went to three to four, it got easier. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on ever, doing more than one Squirrel? And, as you look forward to your upcoming second project, do you have plans down the line for more growth? Is that something that you think about right now?
Gosh, I would just like to get this one open, you know, like I'm so like in the moment that I just need to get this, I need to get it open and operational and like, let it crawl, you know, like let it learn to walk. Like that's what I think about. I would love to support projects from some of my chefs currently. You know, I think all of us are looking to grow and spread our wings and evolve. And I know that my own chefs have a path that they would like to go down. And there's some of them that I'd really like to champion. So I mean, in my head, do I have other projects that I would love to do? Yes. Do I want to do another Squirrel? I don't know. I think that there's something really special about this, like it's on a corner. It feels it's its own thing. It's really iconic for the neighborhood. Let it be that for now. And let me focus on getting Tell open. And hopefully I can evolve some of my own cooks and help them find their own space and their own voice and you know, champion them.
Jessica, thanks so much for joining us. When can people go to Tell? When is it going to be open?
It's supposed to be open this year, and with all sorts of building and permit and Department of Transportation issues, it's always a quiet cry.
So for the time being, if they come to LA, they can visit you at Squirrel, which is on
Virgil and Marathon, and then Tell should be open next year in early spring.
Thanks again for joining us, everyone. Please join us every Tuesday here on Heritage Radio for a new episode of The Line.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.